Yes, I mean, Ngala in many ways is saying that the old political guard, the 60s elite, as you mentioned, is on its way out. In the interim, I don't know, perhaps if you'd tell us what Deputy Vice President is calling the hustler movement. What do you make of this movement within the current political climate of BBI and a formation of a new kind of political elite?
That would be an interesting, seeing who gets to be part of, the next political elite, if you will, and how power will basically reproduce itself within our generation. But also have to be cognizant of the fact that political clusters, political elites like we have right now, tend to reproduce after themselves. So sometimes when you say we have more younger people at the top, they're in every way and in every bit representative, sometimes and in certain spaces and certain contexts of the what we would call, quote unquote, the old guard, And so these transitions definitely are something to watch out for. We are a very young country, as I said, I mean, at 19.7 years on average, which means transitions happen very fast in a lot of other spaces. I think it would be important to have that within our politics. Not that we've fared badly before. We have one governor who got into office while he was still a youth. The numbers, I think, is almost around 60 for within the parliamentary space. That's about 130 something within the MCA level. And so, I mean, we've had youths in these spaces. These transitions are rarely neat and, sort of clear cut point at, a certain, basically dispensation. So they happen gradually and over time, you notice that younger people are stepping into these spaces, including the challenge that was done on this BBI document at the courts. I mean, we had Esther Ngao, we had Ogunda, we had a whole bunch of young people who were central to, the defense of the constitution recently. So these transitions will happen. These transitions are not automatic. A different kind of young people need to step into that space. You cannot simply assume that because it's younger people that they represent a different mindset, a different frame, a different way of looking at this thing, because the current political space have the resources to reproduce themselves in basically in younger people or age mates. And sort of to keep perpetuating some of the vices or political vices that we see right now. So it is important that we are able to deliberately stay in that space, deliberately ask not just the youth question, but who really are these young people who want to be in this space and do they represent basically different? When it comes to the hustler conversation, I mean, it was a one-time opportunity to have a sort of a ground up conversation around this country, considering the etymology of the word hustler itself, how it's been used until up until the time it got politicized. I mean, it was a way of basically trying to describe the lifestyle of many people, how you are able to build yourself from the ground up. The fact that it was politically taken advantage of and basically taken up by one arm of basically, the current political contestation was a big loss, honestly, within the civic and national conversation for people. Because, I mean, you can no longer go out there and say, I hustle, I'm a hustler, because it carries certain political undertones, a certain level of political baggage, if you will, because of its association with the vice president. Having said that, I think younger people have way more opportunities to, challenge a lot of what's happening right now within social media spaces, within publications, within conversations like what we are having here, and in many other spaces and forums where our peers and our age mates are having this conversation. I think it would be important for us to take stock of what we were able to do up until, let's say, 2017, and ask ourselves, can we better that going into 2022? Can we have more women in that spaces? And what are we doing upfront to ensure that that works? Are we doing that for people living with disabilities? Are we doing that for, regional, ethnic, religious minorities? Are we doing that for every other cluster of people whose voice is not at the table, so to speak? So in many ways, I think the hustler conversation was you know, unfortunately hijacked, but it was a critical conversation in terms of how we process our socio-political and socio-economic realities, especially in terms of how people are able to, you know, basically earn their keep in this country. I mean, there's the old saying in Nairobi, you know, like it can be a nickel to a hustle, like leave it at that, you know, people somehow find how to make money within this bizarre economy that is very labor intensive without enough opportunities for young people. So within that kind of, you know, these number of variables, the core of it would be, are we still willing to, you know, what Kihika is doing with the team to step into that space? Are we preparing enough young people on this end such that within the next 16 months, you have more representation there, you have more voice there, you have, you're better organized, you know, in that space, because nobody's going to hand us anything for free. You know, are we better organized? Are we clear about what we want to go and do in that space, including challenging some of these things, like including some of the political and legislative, you know, shenanigans they're playing, BBA being the biggest of them all. So it would be important, number one, to take stock of what we've done. And I think we've done impressively, especially in 2017. And number two, are we building up towards ensuring that this transition is not automatic or a given, but it's something that will be guided towards ensuring that a new crop of people get in there who are able to articulate newer realities in that space, who are able to bring in new perspectives, who are able to challenge some of the age-old traditions that have been cemented in that space, some of which are generational blind spots of, you know, the older generations, their contributions, of course, notwithstanding. Yeah.
Great. Ngala, before I go back to Shiko, Darius had mentioned about, you know, this transition period between this old guard and, I mean, we can't call it a new guard yet, but there's a contestation happening. What's the political and historical context finding where we're seeing this elite fragmentation, but not this elite contest happening today? And I think BBI is very much part of that contestation. If you may just contextualize that for us historically.
So I think that there what we need to know, and Daria say something, that the transitions happen, but sometimes they're not very neat, and this is like very, very true. I think what we have now in Kenyan politics is that there's a struggle between two generations of a political elite. So this is informed by like Kenyan history. So Kenya like begins life as a colony, in 1920, you know, then the name Kenya, you know, 1920. But then the kind of logic of governance at that time, it was that a few people had decided in the name of white settlers, and of course the colonial administrators, a few people had decided that they could govern the entire territory, right? That they could control its fate, that they could decide its economic policies, everything. And this became the logic of governance in Kenya up until 1963, when we were gaining independence, right? So the cohort that took over power from the colonialists continued that political logic. They did not know anything else, right? They did not know things like participation, broad-based mass mobilization. In fact, they demobilized the nationalist movement. You know, someone like Tom Mboya actually, who was a very important figure in the labor union movement in the 1950s, is the one who actually kills it in the 1960s. And this is because not only is institutionally, the way the state was organized, the executive was more powerful than parliament and judiciary and civil society, but also the political elite who took over the executive branch had been socialized to rule in such a way that they did not need to listen to the voices of the masses, right? That they are the ones who knew where the country needed to head. But such a political system is only possible, and you know this. I'm describing Kenyatta's rule, but that was only possible if those elites have a bit of consensus around that system, right? And to have consensus around that system is if there is enough revenue and money to wed this political elites within the system, right? So for them to legitimize the system. So if you have If you have Rangala from the coast, you have Ngei from Ukambani, you know, you have all these political leaders who are representing their ethnic regions to legitimize Kenyatta's rule. But for Kenyatta to keep them at the center, there had to be revenue and money to basically oil that system, right? So when Moi becomes president, this no longer becomes possible, right? And therefore we witness an episode of elite fragmentation. So elites begin to, you know, Moi in the 1980s, known as the dark period in Kenyan politics, becomes very, very paranoid, especially with the 1982 coup. And therefore is basically killing off the system. And leaders who had been respected in their regions are either in exile, are detained without trial, or even end up dead. But of course, in the 1990s, that could no longer hold. So what we see in the 1990s is extreme fragmentation at the center, and violence at the local level. But what is important, and this is the point I'm trying to make here, is that during the 1990 period of informalization, right, where we are moving from a quietist economic system where a few elites are getting all the benefits of independence and others are just following, in the 1990s it's different, because in 1990s, informalization enters sort of like a deregulation phase, right? And that period produces this all sorts of hustlers, right? What we call new money, right? That begins in 1990. So if you trace the economic history of individuals such as Hassan Joho, such as Sonko, such as Ruto, like if you trace the economic history, it all goes back to something that happened in the 1990s, right? And the 1990s ushers this period of the new entrepreneurial spirit, who does not necessarily need to have gone to school or anything, but they can do some to deals here and there and make money, right? So it is this kind of generation that is raised by the Moi years of informality that is now clashing with the generation of the 60s and the 70s, right? And represented, of course, at the top by Uhuru Kenyatta and Raila Odinga. I mean, their fathers were the leaders of the political elite of the 60s and 70s.
Right.
And that elite is now fighting or competing for power with the elite that was born by the times of the 90s, and the early 2000s, these difficult periods. I really like when Darius was talking about in Nairobi now, when you ask someone what they do, it's actually sort of like a taboo question. Yeah. But these times were born out, we can trace them to the 1990s. Yeah. When people are leaving universities and there are no jobs, right? Like, right, the time of the expanding Jua Kali sector, for example. So you have all these Babu Owinos, you have all these characters that have now, because the new constitution has opened political spaces, that have now entered the political field, yeah? They are now MCAs, they are now MPs, they are becoming senators and they're becoming governors. And they want to also, unfortunately, they don't want to transform the system, but they want to be included in the system, right? So the system needs to open up. Now what the BBI is doing is that the BBI is actually closing off the system by reconcentrating power on the presidency and in Nairobi. You know, the president, with the latest BBI report, the second BBI report, the president gets to appoint not only a cabinet, but the prime minister and two deputies. The president gets to appoint the chair of what will be the National Police Council that then ends up controlling the police. The president appoints an ombudsman who sit at the judiciary. So the BBI actually really proposes to decentralize power at the center. Yet, as our history is showing us, the more the country grows, the more people will begin to ask for power and position, right? And the BBI is going against that. And I think that is what William Ruto symbolizes now. William Ruto symbolizes this when, I think it was a very clever move to pick up on this name Hustler, because everyone now, most people in Nairobi now describes themselves as, they describe themselves as hustlers, meaning fanya biashara, a hustle too. right? And I think like it was a very clever political move to tap into that emotion, an emotion of people feeling that a certain political elite needs to go away and we need to be in charge, not necessarily to change our political traditions or to transform the system, but to also continue what the old guard was doing, but now for more people, right? And the BBI is at the center of that struggle.
Interesting. Shiko, just to come to you. I mean, on June 1st, the president in his Madaraka's Day speech said that constitutions shouldn't be yokes unto us as a people, but they need to be fluid and agile, to paraphrase him, not verbatim, meaning that we should change that. In your perspective, and he was making a case for BBI, for the BBI process and the BBI document to pass through, it being a yoke. In your perspective, how has the Constitution of Kenya really opened up the space for more players to engage with him? And what do you think BBI wants to do in this regard? Is it closing the political elite, or it's really closing up? Just to paraphrase Ngala, is it holding a yoke on the political elite?
The BBI basically is meant to come and shut most of us up and sort of strengthen the spaces for the elites. And these are like very specific people. For me, the Constitution 2010, sort of like, I think Ngala has said it very well. And you see, the challenge is when you're talking after someone's wisdom who's able to put things diplomatically, you're not able to actually articulate your own issues. But the point is, when the Constitution 2010 came to pass, the funny thing is that I was a child. I didn't know what was happening. I only knew we had bananas and oranges. That is the much I can remember. And then I remember at some point we had colors for whatever reason. But now, being that I'm benefiting from this constitution, in what way? My freedom of expression is out here. I'm able to speak. I'm able to say, you know what, this is it. Public participation, which has never been followed, which has never been implemented in any way. So we have so many documents that support this. This is one of the things I think BBA is coming to close down on. This is when the president wants everything to be up to him appointing so and so, then are we not trying to sort of close this so-called yoke in a way that it's only the political elite who are able to do some things? It's only through the president that some things are able to move. When you tell me that the president now is going to appoint the ombudsman who goes to sit in the judiciary, and then you also tell me that the president will also appoint the prime minister, at what point does the opposition of this country have a voice? At what point do we say that the president is wrong when he's wrong? And I honestly feel like BBI is meant to strengthen the dictatorship. The mild dictatorship of Uhuru is about to be strengthened by that document. And that is why he's so courageously telling you people that, oh, we don't have money for an election in 2022, but we have money for BBI in 2021. Which doesn't make sense at all. That, we need to move. Like, the IEBC has the courage to come and tell us that we are not ready for an election, but how ready are they for the BBI? Why did they say we're not ready for a referendum at that specific point? Because it's about manipulation so that it works for the best of Uhuru and Raila. So when I look at it, I just feel like Uhuru will say anything. He does not write his speeches. He probably doesn't even know who writes them. He reads them to you. They look cute. They look beautiful, but there's nothing to it that can be implemented.
Mm-hmm. Darius, one of the key things that Katiba 2010 did was to check what people call the colonial state, and the independent constitution that was birthed post 1963 was by and large mutilated. By the time we were changed in 2010, it had been changed fundamentally 39 times. If you may, couple of things. One, because you've written about this, you've talked about this in very many spaces. What do we mean by the colonial state? And secondly, what was it about the Katiba 2010 that was meant to reform and fix this colonial state? And within that context, What does BBI take us forward in fixing the colonial state, or does it actually re-entrench back the colonial state?
Thank you, Joe. I think in many ways, the workings of the 2010 constitution are very different from the workings of what we call the 1963 constitution in terms of it being a product of a very brief space within this country where the elite were able to have an honest conversation amongst themselves. And they're able to say, you know what, this centralization of power, this centralization of the Kenyan reality, this othering of people who do not fit within certain frameworks of what is considered acceptable to the central state, basically this new model, this new constitution essentially pushed that out. You know, it ensured that as much power is going into the devolved counties, you know, firming up and strengthening some of the, you know, our institutions and especially the judiciary, moving, of course, a lot of this power away from the hands of a few people. And that is a very fundamental, aspect of our governance system, because it creates a kind of what we call checks and balances that ensures, as the High Court affirmed, you know, you have to do public participation. And, you know, this is entrenched in the constitution, especially when it comes to budgetary issues, you know, the civil education on people. And the Constitutional Assembly, of course, in as much as it has its flaws and, you know, it's been subject to the excesses and, basically bullying by the executive, it can still hold, it's there. I mean, we can always come back to it and reform it. And especially if we get more younger people in there who are willing to bring in new ideas on how to, you know, basically do, the respective constitutional assemblies, of course. And in many ways, what a colonial state is basically this logic, and I think Ngala has spoken into it. It's this logic, this model of working that simply erases anyone who does not fit within the narrow confines of what it defines as, you know, as a human being, as a Kenyan. And this happened with the land ordinance in 1902, the Kipande tax, of course, the Hart tax, and a lot of history in there. And this, the logic of this system essentially is, you know, everyone else who does not fit the narrow confines of definition of who's truly Kenyan. And this is never really on paper, but it's built into the workings of the system. You know, you have a police system that was generally built to, you know, serve the elites and not you. You have an education system that is built to entrench the tyranny of the 3%. That is why you look at a country like Kenya, 54 million people, 28.5 million adults, but you only have 900,000 graduates. And suddenly the Minister of Education starts clamping down on that. And, you know, because apparently we have too many graduates, because 900,000 is in the, you know, in the logic of that system or exclusionary system, is too many people, and especially it's beginning to include people who, you know, from lower clusters, socioeconomically, regionally, that the system doesn't consider acceptable. And so that logic, I mean, it's built into education system, it's built into our church system, our religious systems rather, it's built into, you know, our policing system, it's built into even how we do infrastructure development in this country, you know. And within all these basically outworkings, that system didn't change in 63. I mean, we made incremental reforms here and there, you know, hits and misses, setbacks here and there, but largely the system was able to, you know, sort of sustain its logic through successive parliament, through successive presidents, some of whom have given it varying levels of, you know, basically support and operationalization within the country. But now we come to 2010, this system that sort of in many ways pushes not enough, but a lot of power from the center relative to what we've done before. And of course, you can understand the recoil that you're seeing with the elites. I mean, it's what, again, Galato mentioned in the, in, you know, 63 happens, you know, the Majimbo system comes in. But then within a short period of time, we realize that the colonial logic always wants to work in a way that everybody gazes at the center and the center decides, you know, basically it's the theater of the political elite, you know. And so there's this recoil and the Majimbo system is thrown out. 2010, we basically recreated 63 in certain aspects, and barely within what? We're barely 11 years into this, we're seeing the same elite do that very gut reaction of, you know, colonial perpetrators who are basically recoiling again, because within this system, power is not supposed to be people, whether it's social power, economic power, widening the definition of who gets to be Kenyan or who is Kenyan and how this works for everyone else. And so within that understanding that this is a very, if I will, natural reaction of the elites within a system that was built to centralize everything. That once power begins to get out of that space, social power, political power, economic power, representation, voices in terms of including young people, you know, people in the northern region and every other in the coast, in, you know, in Nyanza for the longest time with the marginalization. Once you begin to bring these people, to give these people more power in terms of how shaping the fate of the country, shaping the fate of, you know, of you know, their respective regions, then they literally always react back. They want to claw back on that power. And in as much as they're promising you 35% devolution, it wouldn't mean much if the same person gets to control all these other respective seats and appoints all these other people around him, which are really supposed to be powerful positions, appointed by one person who's even now almost all powerful and is almost sort of, you know, a shield around themselves to protect themselves from the kind of accountability that, you know, distributing power does to basically that seat and the people around him, so to speak.
Just to reiterate what Derek said very, very briefly. So the 2010 constitution was named, we said it picked on the American style presidential system, yeah? Even the way it created the Senate, you know, bicameral legislature, and this presidential system. But why, you know, in a country of over 300 million people, the United States, why have they not felt, why have the political elites there not felt that they need to increase more positions at the center? It's simply because there are so many people who are in charge of running the country, right? Through the federal system. And therefore people do not feel that they will not get a job or their keto will not have a place to go, basically not have a market for your products because the president is not from your area, right? So in Kenya, how do you create a system where people don't have to fight because their guy did not win the election, because they feel that their life will continue the same way it used to be. If your children will still go to school and that there'll be books there, that there'll still be security, that your children will still be promised of a job after finishing university. If people feel that these things are not threatened, you know, these basic life things are not threatened, I don't feel that they will need to fight for a person who's from their region to be president. And the only reason why people feel that they need to do that is because the system is so much centralized. And even when you had devolution, that was not even powerful enough, was not really what people wanted. The current administration has worked against this devolution as well. This kind of devolution that doesn't have the power. So this need, right, just to support what Derek was saying, this need to always centralize power at the center, I feel is the problem, right? And I feel that the only way we're going to have this thing we're calling inclusivity and lasting peace is if we allow many people to be control of their own fate and to be control of what we call, to actually take part in governance, and not a few people in Nairobi.
Mm. Just to pick, before I go back to Shiko Ngala, I mean, in the last couple of years, I mean, from 2013 to 2017, we saw a fairly active judiciary, you know, pushing back very many of presidential executive orders and saying that many of them were illegal. In 2017, the same judiciary annulled the presidential election. On June 2nd this year, the BBI judgment, the High Court called the BBI process constitutional null and void. What do you make of this particular judiciary within a context that the judiciary in the colony was a kangaroo court? So how do you make that transition? But more importantly, is it seems in very many regards that the judiciary has become the last arbiter for Kenya's struggle. Is that a good way to go for Kenyans, whereby all our political problems we run to the judiciary?
Yes, and I think, look, like if the judiciary is doing its job,
right,
that's basically another way of saying that we need to be a country that follows the rule of law. Mm-hmm. That's what the judiciary protects the law and makes the law work, right? So if the judiciary is not working, then you're not a country that is based on the rule of law. That's exactly what it means. But then the question is, how did we get there? Like how do we now have an judiciary that is very dependent and can make decisions that go against the wishes of the executive? This has not been our experience, right, in our history. How do you explain that? And I think I've argued elsewhere that the serious fragmentation at the center, you know, when elites are busy fighting themselves at the center, that is when you have witnessed the most fundamental transformations in this country, actually, right? But when the elites have agreed on the rules of the game, that is when basically like the whole country is going to come under their domination, right? So it is very instructive to note that the new constitution, well, now it's no longer new, but the 2010 constitution comes into being after the post-election violence, right? So it's important to think about this kind of crisis moments and how they usher interesting developments after, right? So our first crisis point was the Mau Mau in the mid 1950s, where the colonial state could no longer hold, right? Immediately after that, the second crisis point is the post-election violence, right? Where this serious elite fragmentation that had been happening since the 1990s needed to be stopped. People needed to actually agree on the rules of the game, right? And that is basically the National Accord of 2008, which produces this new constitution. But since political trust was still very low amongst the political elites, that gave an opportunity for voices to come from outside and to make sure that the new constitution is protected, so that even when you want to amend it, the guardrails of amend the constitution are going to be so high, right? It also, this kind of lack of political trust between the political system, where within the political elites who are busy trying to fix each other, it allowed for people in the committee of experts to create provisions within the new constitution that would then create a very dependent judiciary and also dependent constitutional commissions, right? So for the politicians at that time in 2010, it's very important to look at the political environment that produces these changes. The politicians in 2010, they were all busy thinking about who's going to become next president after Mwai Kibaki, right? And therefore, how do you use the new constitution to do that, right? So I am very sure that they did not even pay a lot of attention to the details of that new constitution, right? So long as people have agreed, as they did in Naivasha in 2009 and 2010, there was no longer points of debate that were very serious, right? I think actually the people who opposed the new constitution in 2010, did not even raise serious matters of the structure of government. They were talking about things like abortion and things like that. So. But what the political elite, which is why I'm saying that sometimes they're not very smart, is that they did not know that they were passing a constitution that would, in very few short years, go against their interests, right? Mm. And I think it is now becoming very, very apparent. Yeah.
Right. I mean, Shiko, how do we start building or keep building a critical mass of youth, because you work with youth a lot, particularly around for them to have a critical mass of people who support, endorse, and actually apply constitutionalism within the context of Katiba 2010. How do we start? Because in a sense that there have been very many false starts, even with regards to progressive forces you know, recently we were with you recently at the Sabah Sabah convention, and the convention, and there were very many thoughts around how do you start to build a critical mass of people to now begin the process of implementation, but on top of that, to endorse and legitimize constitutionalism within Kenya.
So I will say we need to understand that the work of mobilizing and speaking on people's problem is not the work of the civil society, because we've made it our business. We've made it that this is our work. Our work is to speak for the people. We must stop speaking for these young people. We must allow them to speak for themselves. We must start working with them instead of working for them. Because one thing that I've learned over time and over the few years that I've been in this space is that even when we say we are organizing, we want to organize the way our forefathers organized. We are forgetting that we have sort of evolved, especially with the new technology. We have evolved in terms of how people react to problems. Like, it's only in Kenya where mafuta inapanda, mtu anakuambia mimi sina gari, so I knew so. Then you forget that at the same time that fuel goes up, your unga at your kibanda will go up. So it's just that we do not have this knowledge, and this is where we need to start. We honestly, honestly need to be honest enough and tell ourselves about the actual history and the true history of this land. Because sometimes I listen to people speaking, and when Gala was talking about our history, I smiled, because there's one thing I keep saying, majority of us as young people, especially the 90s, going back to the 2000s, we barely know this history. We barely know what happened during those times. The history we read in school is quite corrupted, that we are meant to praise the oppressors, that we are meant to uphold the people who have been stealing from us ever since. So we must acknowledge that it's time we organize, but organize thinking that the generation we are targeting is very different. We must allow the youth to be part of these spaces that we're talking about. And we must also think about, and this is one thing, and I think, Joe, I mentioned that when we were with you just the other day, is that instead of looking at the youth who are always on their phones as quote-unquote idiots, look at this as an opportunity. Look at this as a way that we can actually start mobilizing using those things. The same way if something small happens, it turns into a meme and goes viral, is the same way our revolution can go viral. If we only organize and allow these young people to be, like, you know, meeting them at their own problems. If you tell a young person right now about taxes and all this, they will tell you I file zero returns. But if you start telling them from the point of why you are unemployed and why you went to school for 4 years to tarmac for the next 10 years is because this government doesn't like you and this is what is happening, then maybe we'll start changing the narrative. We must start changing the way we approach things. We must also say, if the civil society does everything, what is the role of the government? And I keep telling people, if we go to solve people's problems, then the people do not need to pay taxes to the government. We must start capacity building people to be able to understand that they deserve the best and they should demand the best, because the government owes them. They do not owe the government. Literally, we give money to this government so that it can render us services. But instead, we give them money to loot and they borrow on top of it. So maybe it's time we start having this genuine conversation. And as we talk of organizing, can we also be genuine with ourselves and say, let us also bring in the new brains, the new energy, and this this block that we call the young people on the table. Let us stop making boardroom decisions to solve solutions in this country.
Okay. Darius, very quickly, I mean, I'd like to open this up to some questions from our viewers and audiences, but very quickly, part of negating people humanity or a segment of society is always to freeze frame them, and the youth in this country for a long time are freeze framed, as I mentioned earlier, within two categories: either as the face of violence and these truants who go around, you know, investing in crime and drugs and all sorts of vices, or on the other hand, there is this cluster that are helpless and needs to be saved. From at a level of language, how do we begin to move to move this conversation, to stop seeing the youth within these two frames and see them as actual active citizens of this country who can participate in governance, not at the point of mobilizing for these big politicians, but who can actually lead, can steer progressive conversations, debates, legislation, policies for this country.
It's a well-wired system that ensures, you know, you don't get to see them as, you know, people who should be, you know, in the room making those decisions. And as I said, there's much more nuance that, you know, younger people can be able to bring into this conversation. I know we partly did that in 2018 with the Millennial Series, where we were basically saying, you know, our story is not about IG and Java. It's about the fact that systems and processes in this country do not allow a lot of young people, and so many young people, to be able to move through these ranks and to be able to be, you know, to make meaningful contribution to the society. But also there are so many young people out there who are trailblazing, are doing incredible things in fantastic spaces out there. And I think it's important to tell their stories, you know, not all of them, of course, but as I mentioned earlier, like in politics, you have a governor who basically fit the criteria of young people. His performance, of course, is something you'll be able to unpack and say, did he perform well, didn't he? I mean, you have about 60-something among the members of parliament, among those who vote. We have so many MCAs who fit that category, and that's just in politics. You can have the same conversation within activism spaces. One of the most important things to do to break this passivity and pathology kind of very strict frames given to the youth is to bring in nuance, is to tell the story of the diversity of pursuits, of talents, of ideas, of accomplishments that, you know, and of interests that young people are pursuing, whether it's in politics, in law, in philosophy, in academia, you know, in recreation, in whatever, in every space that young people are existing. So I think it's very, very important to invest within, to invest in nuance in telling the story of young people. And so that you don't end up with this passivity, pathology, but also I think it's something Ngala had mentioned, that the youth are monolithic cluster, which they are not, you know. By being able to bring nuance into conversation about young people, you're able to break these sort of, you know, very strict ways in which, and very convenient ways in which they try to define youths, such that, you know, they're not allowed at the table of decision-making, yeah.
Thank you. Thanks for that, Darius. I just want to quickly go to some of the questions that have been raised to the panel. The first question is by Othiambo Omino. Thanks for joining us. This question I'll shoot to Ngala. And Othiambo asks, what do you think of the foreign influences in processes such as BBI? And do you know of any such foreign influences that have matters on BBI?
From what we know, I mean, the answer is no, right? So like the money came from the government. In fact, the case against the BBI was raised in the sense that it was primarily a government executive project that used public funds. However, I have to say that the pressure that may have informed the coming up with the BBI or the handshake, the international community did actually have a hand in that, right? In pressuring the government to come up with a solution, especially those few months after August 2017, when we went for the election. But I am not aware of any underhand foreign influence that has supported the BBI process, either financially or even politically. No, I'm not aware of that.